welcome to Better Than Mario Brothers, where each episode we delve deep into cinema sewer. I am Chris Bolton. With me, as always, the incomparable Miss Hallie McIntyre.
Hiya.
And no Mark this month. This is unfortunately Mark's got some stuff he's got to deal with. Quite sad about that, because I'd be very interested to hear what Mark thought of this month's film, primarily because, and I'm sure we'll dive into this, I kind of feel like it's something that me and Mark may have very, very well have written like 15 years ago. It feels like something we would do. Just, you know, maybe not up to the caliber that we would do it at, perhaps. Anyway, that's for in a couple of minutes' time. Before we dive in to Poltergeist, I do just have to briefly rewind back to last episode, because I made a promise at the end of last episode that if I could find an uncensored, unedited version of Bunny the Killer Thing, I would watch it. And I did. In, you know, some of the less legal corners of the internet, shall we say, some of the dark nether regions that I don't normally like to explore, I managed to find the full unedited version of Bunny the Killer Thing. As we expected, it is a very different film. A very, very different film. Doesn't really change the disgusting rape elements at all. Doesn't add too much context in terms of story at all. But what it does do is completely, completely change the tone. It is incredibly graphic. Incredibly graphic. Like, I can totally understand now why it was winning awards at exploitation cinema festivals and stuff like that. It's much better. Much, much, much better. I still only understood about a third of it because it's still no subtitles or dubbing. I don't think ultimately it changes my opinion. It's still not better than Mario. But I do think it is a marked improvement. So if anyone out there is still wanting to watch Bunny the Killer Thing or did watch it after last episode, it's worth tracking down that uncut version. I'll just say that. The uncut version is at least good for a laugh until the rape. And then it's horrible again. But yeah. So it's out there. It's out there, and I'm not necessarily eating humble pie, but I will give props where they do. It is a better film, I think, than we gave it credit for last episode. So just want to make reparations for that. So that being said, on to it couldn't be more different. On to something completely different. 2007's Poltergeist. Now, this has actually been on the list for this podcast since even before Helen joined. One of the things...
And ironically enough, I came to it completely separately of, like, the list of films.
Totally. When we were planning this episode, Helen said, I've had a recommendation for Poltergeist. And instantly I was like, that's on the list. I put it on the list because one of the things this podcast does, listeners, is completely fuck your recommendations on every streaming platform.
Yes. I can't watch Amazon.
No. Like, so Amazon recommended Poltergeist to me a long, long time ago. And I saw the title and I was just like, I don't need to read anymore. Just that title alone, Poltergeist, like, this needs to go on the list. And then, Helen, you mentioned that somebody actually recommended it to you, said we should take a look at it.
Yeah, and there was somebody as well that really got the concept of the podcast, which was one of the reasons why I was just like, I'm really up for this, because we'd had a lot of conversations in the past about films that we'd watched for this podcast. So I was like, it sounds like it's a solid choice for the channel, because they kept on sort of saying to me, don't get me wrong, it's not a good film, and would I watch it again? Probably not, but I actually enjoyed myself. And I was like, well, do you know what? Fuck it, let's go for it.
That's what this is all about, right? And I won't bury the lead. I really fucking enjoyed this. Is it a good film? Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's a great film. But I don't think it's a bad one. And would I watch it again? Yes, absolutely, I would. I really enjoyed it. I'll be honest. I really, really enjoyed this.
I'll be honest as well. When it started off, I thought the film was very much going down one route.
So did I.
Obviously, we'll get more into this. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they didn't go for that and the route that they chose to take and where the film ended, you could probably hear in my voice, I'm a little bit unwell at the moment. And yesterday I went home early from work because it got to 3 o'clock and I couldn't do it anymore. So I had to have a sleep. And I just had some dinner on my sofa and I was a bundle of blankets and snot feeling like crap when I watched this. And I felt in a really good mood afterwards. And I was like, yeah, this was exactly what I needed to watch.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I've had quite a busy month, so I didn't actually watch this until this afternoon, and I did similar to you. I just knocked off early. Thankfully, my job allows me to take flexi time, so I was just like, right, I've got a podcast tonight. I'm just going to knock off early and watch this. And it was just perfect, like, middle of the afternoon. Like, you know, it kind of feels, even though I was legitimately taking time off work, it kind of felt like I was throwing a bit of a sickie, like I'm playing hooky a little bit, and I just dumped this on, and I don't know, maybe all the stars aligned or something, but I just had a great time with it. But like you, when it started, I was initially quite nervous because it started going down one route and didn't know where that was going to take me. And then it just became something completely different. And as the film went on, I got more and more and more into it. And that's actually one of the reasons why I think it felt to me like something perhaps that Mark and I would have written, you know, back 15 years ago, because I've always been very big on a bait and switch. Like, it's something I do a lot, and mashing genres together is something I do a lot as well. So I could see a little bit of myself in this. I could see a little bit of Mark in what it eventually becomes with the whole kind of rom-com with the your average Joe kind of scenario. And then the fact that you've just got this troupe of gay disco dancers, you're just thrown in to the middle of,
like,
everything.
What I will warn you about now, because if you watch it this afternoon, you haven't had the chance to experience this, is I've had Ra Ra Rasputin stuck in my head.
Oh, yeah.
Since I watched this. And I commented on it at work to Mikey, who'd recommended it to me. And then about 3 hours later, he was like, why am I singing it? Why am I singing this particular song? And I was just like, Poltergeist. And he was just like, oh, shit, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know Ra Ra Rasputin was going to feature quite so heavily in the film.
But I'm here for it, by the way.
So I love that song.
I love it.
Yeah, so do I. Absolutely fucking love it. Takes me right back to, like, workman's clubs growing up. You know, just being in there on Saturday night with Mum and Dad in the disco would just blare shit like that. So I'm fully here for Ra Ra Rasputin. But yeah, it's as soon as I heard it, I made a note on it. It was like, oh my fucking God, it's Ra Ra Rasputin.
Because when I first started driving, obviously this is back in the days when all of your cars had tape decks, is I had masses and masses of just, like, unlabeled cassettes, which were like mixes. And back in those days as well, I was very heavily into the metal and rock music. So everything was very much, all of the tapes were sort of mixes along this, apart from one which I had, which was my tape of Ultimate Cheese. And nobody would know which one it was because it looked like all of the others. And I had it in there just for my own amusement. And it opened with Ra Ra Rasputin because the thing is most of the metalheads that I had in my car had never heard it. And their reaction to hearing it for the first time just gave me life.
It's a quality tune. It's a fucking banger.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. It's a fucking banger. So I'm here for the soundtrack, full stop. I think the soundtrack's really, really good. If I've got a couple of pages of notes, but, well, I say a couple. I've got literally 2.5 pages of notes. I've not got, unfortunately, this podcast may not be very long this time because I've not really got a lot of criticism. And most of my notes are just me shouting out things that I liked. And most of the time, I wasn't actually writing because I was so heavily invested in this. Like, I watched this. I did, like, there was no real critical eye. By the time we hit about the 30-minute mark, I was pretty much, like, pad down by the side of me, and I was watching it. I really enjoyed this film.
It's not a massive criticism, but what I will say, and we've both sort of, like, commented on this, that we thought it was going down another route, was when I thought it was going down that first route, it wasn't that I wasn't here for it, but I was a little bit like, okay, I'm not sure how well you're going to pull all of this off. And I'm also, I'm not particularly enamored of this main character, this is the story that we're going to do.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm reserving judgment. And then when they decided that they weren't going to do that, they did a hard swerve. And instead it became the warmest, most heartfelt little story ever. Like, this is a genuine feel-good film.
It's a real feel-good rom-com. And I didn't expect that. I really didn't.
Yeah, just the ending is so
perfect. Oh, the ending's lovely. I've commented on the ending because it doesn't quite land. Because you're right, it's not a perfect film. There are problems with it. And they all stem from that opening. The ending, the problems with the ending stem back to the opening and some of the issues midway. So I'll call them up. But yes, there are problems, but they always manage to stay just on the right side of them. It never becomes a huge mess. And no. I think that's credit to everyone involved. I think that's credit to the writers. I think that's credit to the director, and it's certainly credit to the cast. I think, to me, and this is just my opinion, I don't really know anything about the background of this film at all. Like, I knew nothing about it other than the title going in. I've not had any time to research it after the fact. But it feels to me, and I commented this on my notes as well, because the editing in places is horrendous, right? We fade to black and fade up from black a lot, which is the most annoying part of the film. And I get the feeling that this was probably, I think there's probably another 20 or 30 pages of script here that isn't on the screen. And I think they were probably shot. I do think they were shot. I just think then when it was finally put together and assembled, once it started doing the circuit and we're looking for distribution and things like that, I think some fucking marketing idiot or studio head went, oh, you need to, this is a rom-com, it needs to be 90 minutes. You need to, and we've lost some story in there. Well, not so much story, it's character work that we've lost, particularly for Mark, our lead. I think the performer does a phenomenal job to get us on board. He is excellent. He is really, really good. But I think there's some Act One information that we really needed from him to set that character up, to set us off on the trajectory and to allow that. And then this stuff then with the club at the end, with the gays, this stuff that we get in passing that allows all of that to pay off. And it's fine because we've got it. But I feel like other than one of their stories, which pays off really, really nicely, the rest of them could have probably had a better payoff there as well, were that screen time in there. And I genuinely think it's been written because it feels like it's being played. And those fades to black, they're not a conscious... That's no way is that a conscious decision that any director, regardless of experience level, would make. You wouldn't do that. You would find a way to cut. You wouldn't fade to black and fade up from black. You just wouldn't. So I think it was just a case of...
Because it contrasts, because there's other points where, like, there's really good transitions, like when the camera moves behind the tree and it comes out the other side.
There's some beautiful camera work.
Like, there's... And that's why the fade to black was so jarring, because the point is that you know that they can do it. So it's like, this doesn't fit with everything else.
There's some beautiful camera work. There's some beautiful composition, particularly in that first section where they're leaning into horror a little bit. They fully understand how to shoot that. You know, we get a lot of high angle creeps through that house. There's lots of deep focus shots. So you're constantly peering in the background, looking to see if there are any kind of gay ghosts are going to pop up anywhere. Like, there's a lot of shadow. They fully understand how to shoot a horror film. And when it transitions and it becomes a rom-com, they fully understand the warmth that's needed and your light in there. Like, they know what they're doing. And I just think that had the decision been made before this went to camera that these scenes were going to be cut or that these scenes just weren't there, there's no way that director goes, yeah, we'll just fade to black and fade up from black. You'd find a way to move through the space more neatly than that, because there are points where scenes directly follow each other and we're just missing the interstitial, and it's better to just not have it rather than fade to black and fade up. And I think it's just that it had basically been planned out in such a way that we had an adjoining cut and they were like, oh no, we're losing that scene, but now we've lost the transition, so it's going to look really bad unless we just fade it, because that's all you can do. A fade always means you've forgotten something. It's as simple as that. It never means anything else. If you're fading to black, it's just, oh, we didn't shoot that. So in this case, I think they did. And I think they had to lose stuff. And when they did, the film just didn't, it didn't look right anymore. So the only way around it was to fade. And I think that is the be-all and end-all of every problem I have with this film. I think it all stems back to that. I think there's missing information. That rears its head at a few times throughout the script. And I'll point them out as we go through. So I guess we will go through it. I'll talk through the story as best I can. I mean, it's still fresh in my mind. But like I said, didn't really take any notes because I was so into it. The first thing, I was on edge straight away because the opening isn't great. The needle drop is fine, but then just straight into the club, it feels a little bit pedestrian. Is the problem, you know? There's no threat in that scene, and I get that. Yeah. Now watching it, I get that it's setting the tone for us of like this isn't going to be a really graphic horror film, but
yeah.
When you call Poltergeist and you kind of know the ghosts are involved and you know these guys have got to die, it needed to be a little bit more Final Destination. I think that opening it was a little pedestrian for me. However, it's very very short. And they instantly won me over when the explosion actually happened, because the explosion's funny as fuck on purpose. Like the comedy timing
yeah.
of just a few sparks and then the cut outside and boom, and all the foam's coming out everywhere. Like straight away, I was like, okay. Well, so then I'm expecting just like a kind of goofy comedy horror. That's what it, especially from the credits, that's what I thought I was going to be in for. It was a kind of comedy horror, which I would have been up for, but I was concerned about representation if that was the case. And there are points here where the representation does get a little bit yucky. For me, it never really became a problem, but then I'm a straight white male, so I don't know. Maybe I'm not the best person to comment on that, but there were a few points for me where I just thought, like, that's a little bit close to wire, but it was 20 years ago almost.
Yeah, and the recommendation came from somebody that is very much represented by this film and is very familiar with the eagle.
Well, this is the thing, right? This is the thing. So I say that, as I say, it didn't bother me as a straight white male. However,
yep.
I don't want to be that guy, but I'm a straight white male who has many, many friends like the gays in this film. Yeah. And I also have many who aren't. Still homosexual, but are just not fairies, not queens, not whatever you want to call them. Here they call them fairies, so that's what I'll stick with. And I gotta be honest, I feel like whilst it may be slightly stereotypical, the representation of them as people is more or less there from the ones I know. So
I mean, the point is that they're almost sort of like village people, in that they have. It's a case of that it's not like one uniform type of gay. You've very much got sort of like different members.
You have.
Especially of like the clubbing community that are represented in the five that are there.
Yeah.
And that's how they sort of interact with each other.
Yeah. It just, they all happen to be on the more eclectic end of the homosexual spectrum.
However, we have also got the grandmother, who was
my favorite bit in the whole fucking film.
Yep, same. That was the point where I was like, I love this film.
Me too. I was kind of into it by that point, but it was from there on out, that back half. After Dave the friend, because I made a comment that I thought actually that was a really nicely played scene as well.
Yep.
Where he was, because I've had that scene where I've just been like, yeah, I know, fine. Yeah, that is quite natural in my experience of it. But then the grandmother was just the icing on the cake to go so far the other way, which was amazing. Like, just I spat coffee. It was absolutely fucking hilarious. And there were several points where this film made me laugh out loud, but that was the absolute cherry on the cake. That was absolutely brilliant. There were a few points where the representation was a little bit like, but in general, I think what we do need to draw attention to is, and this needs celebrating, particularly for a film called Poltergeist, is they are never figures of fun. And I think that's the key. They never make fun of them. It's never homophobic. It's never, you know, they are all real people who happen to be funny and we laugh with them. We are never laughing at them. And I think that's key.
It's almost like it's like the horror rom-com comedy version of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Yeah, kind of. It's got that energy to it, hasn't it?
Like the five of them with the sort of the different personality types and how they interact with each other and how they basically end up initially sort of like trying to get Mark to leave Poltergeist style, but then they realize he's such a mess that he's not going to succeed in life without their help, and they go all out to help him.
Yeah.
And he's got this army of just like gay fairy godmothers. I was just here for it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I love the whole concept of it. I think it's brilliant. And they hit it pitch perfect. But yeah, that opening felt like it was going to be something different.
Yeah.
And I was a bit worried. And then as soon as people started speaking, my first note is, thank God this has subtitles. I mean, obviously bearing in mind last month where we can actually understand what was going on. But more importantly, like we constantly say on this show, like, I feel like these performances could be really good if they were just speaking in their native tongue. And it really does make such a difference. It does. Yeah. Like, dubbing is never the way to go. It's really not. It made watching this film and taking notes very fucking difficult. But it's so much better to just hear them talk naturally in their native languages. And the performances here, there's not a bad one amongst the bunch. They're all really good. I was pleased that it had subs. Then Julie Depardieu shows up and I'm like, oh, okay. It's not like she's a superstar, but she's known to me. So I was like, okay, this could be all right. Particularly around this time, kind of late 90s, early 2000s, I was watching a lot of foreign import stuff at this time. So these are faces that I'm pretty familiar with. I'm actually genuinely surprised I haven't seen this before, because this would definitely have been on my radar in like 2006, 2007. So I'm surprised that I haven't watched it. So we get into like we start to creep around the house a little bit, and this is everything that is really well shot. You know, we got this slow creep through. There's all these deep focus shots. I've already spoken about that. But they're very much setting this up as your classic kind of haunted house. You know, you've got the young couple moving in as well, trying to make a go of their first home, and you've got their friend moving in with them, and you've got all the sexual tension from what we later discover is Dave's beard. You've got all of this going on, and it all feels very Amityville. It's very like this house is going to eat these people alive. It's all good. Like, again, the way they're shooting it and the classic tropes they're using, it's all good. I know what it all means. I'm just worried because I kind of know what's coming from the title. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be... And at this point, I was thinking they were just going to go, like, so over-the-top offensive that it would cease to be funny. But they don't at all. I made a note about the editing. We've talked about that. This is the first time you really see it is when there's a point where Mark is carrying a box and he leaves the bedroom and it fades to black. And then it fades up from black in the cellar, which used to be the nightclub. And I'm just like, what? Why have you done that? What? And there's obviously must have been a scene between him leaving the bedroom and going to the cellar. And they've lost that scene. I suspect it was probably a scene with the beard, whose name I keep forgetting. And they've lost it, and then they can't make the match on action. So they've either got... Why they didn't wipe is beyond me. This film, a wipe wouldn't have looked alien in this film. But whatever. It is what it is. I live with the fade to blacks. I hate them. They're the worst thing about the film, but I live with them. And then we get... We get what passes for our setup, and this is the problem with the film, because the only really setup we get with these guys and their relationship is that Dave's beard wants to fuck Mark. Mark is not really interested. And then, what's her name? I haven't written her name down anywhere.
Valerie.
Valerie's kind of a little bit dissatisfied and is throwing herself into a work.
Oh, no, wait, Julie. Julie's the actress. It's
I was going to say Julie's the actress.
It's Emma.
Emma's a little bit.
See, Emma and Mark, the couple moving in, Valerie and Dave.
Yeah.
The friends.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got stereotypes, essentially. And I think there is more work that could be done with these. And I think particularly as we start to get deeper and deeper into what is actually quite a long first act, I start to feel that I really need to know more specifically about Mark. Because it feels like there's a lot more going on there, you know, because there's this whole thing with her dad as well and how Mark isn't good enough for their family and stuff like that. And then he's constantly late to work and he smokes weed. And so you've got all of that kind of average Joe, never going to measure up, doesn't know what he wants from life. That's all fine. I understand all the shorthand language that's being used. But then when we start to delve into his psyche from kind of early act two on, and he starts to think, well, am I gay? Then I don't think we've had enough earlier on for us to kind of go on that ride with him. Thankfully, that's quite a short ride. Because that's the bit that in the middle that doesn't really work for me, that I feel like could earlier on. If we had more about how dissatisfied they both were in their relationship, and, you know, I know, like, they get interrupted fucking by Rara Rasputin and she storms off and stuff like that. But if there's intimacy problems to begin with, then that can all weigh on his mind more, and it just makes more sense.
So I had a slightly different take on how that relationship was functioning right at the very beginning, which was basically that she was ready for next steps because she's talking about, like, nurseries. Yep. And things like this, whereas he's talking about home cinema rooms and she wants the room for entertaining and he's used it to set up a pool table. So basically it's more that he hasn't taken sort of like the next step of sort of away from that sort of, like, you know, the sort of the early 20s at university, mm-hmm. hanging out with your bros type thing. And that's partly what's causing the issues with the dad, is that, you know, he's not fully committed to the work and he's not sort of like hitting like the man goals that he needs to be hitting, because he hasn't sort of like leveled up that way yet. So, but he doesn't, part of the reason why he's not doing that is because Emma's been so committed to him that he hasn't needed to. He's never had that kick because she's always sort of like excused it off and sort of like gone off with other things. And because he's never been in a position of jeopardy where he's had to work for anything, that sort of really he's always managed to sort of coast by, he doesn't realize that his input in that relationship isn't quite enough. Because I think that the dissatisfaction is coming from Emma, because she's like, you know, we've just bought this house together and we've just done all of these. And I think it's more that it's not so much that he's dissatisfied. It's very much not that he's dissatisfied with the relationship. It's that he hasn't realised that he needs to step his game up. Luckily for him, he's got five fantastic characters that will help him to do so.
Yeah, sorry, that's right. That's where I was coming from. Yeah. Perhaps I didn't explain it very well. She's dissatisfied, but what we don't know from him is what he's doing about that, as you've just said, because all we see is, oh, well, I'm going to put a pool table up and I'm going to do a home cinema and I'm going to do it. And so we never really understand. I don't think we understand where he's coming from as a character, why all of a sudden he's so invested in getting her back and stuff like this, other than, oh shit, my life is falling apart. And it's all fine. Like, Christ, I've practically written this character, let's be honest. You know, this is very much the kind of character that I was writing like 15 odd years ago. But I think it's essential, if you're going to do that, to understand what that character wants and how he needs to progress to get there. Because we never really understand ever what Mark actually needs to do to win her back. And he never actually does do anything other than just have a very, very, very good date because his gay besties help him. You know, like he needed a further show of commitment, I think. There needed to be something, or there needed to be something that triggered the separation, at least, other than you're fucking crazy. For him to go on that kind of spiral into self-doubt, you know, and seeing the shrink and being like, oh, well, maybe actually I'm gay and I've just been avoiding all of this. And maybe I'm actually in love with Dave. You know, you can't take that spiral without understanding him to begin with.
Yeah.
So that's what it's missing for me. That's a huge chunk because he's our lead. And I just feel like that information does cast a pretty big shadow over the rest of the film. I think they get away with it because I think they're actually competent enough filmmakers and storytellers to give us the bare minimum. Like we've pulled it all out there, you know, you've got the pool table and you've got the fact that she wants a baby and he doesn't and he's constantly late for work and the dad doesn't like him and he smokes weed and it's all there. They're just missing the interconnecting tissue, I think. There's character work that needs to go in between the two of them much, much earlier on.
But the other thing that wasn't there with this whole, well, maybe it, because obviously he goes to see a shrink and that's when he's sort of told nobody else can see these ghosts. So he starts to think that they're hallucinations that are caused because he's repressing the fact that he's gay. And this was the thing that I thought was really good. This was one of the things where I was really sort of perked up, is there's no internalized or external homophobia
it's
just not a thing.
No.
And that's so freaking refreshing to have. Like, it's a case of, it's not like when he's sort of like questioning if he's gay or not, he's not going through this whole, but I can't be gay because of all of these. He's a case of, well, I've never considered this, but if this is why I'm going through these problems, then okay, I'll embrace this. And nope, definitely not gay. None of this has worked for me. But he doesn't approach it from like that kind of, and I think this is maybe like the French thing coming through, but like I do feel that if this was made in Britain or in America,
oh, it would be totally different film.
You would have even not necessarily explicitly, but you would have like elements of that internalized homophobia, like whether they meant to or not. And just that was, it's also the reason why the Italian grandmother scene hits the way that it does. It's just.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's able to because, as I say, you're laughing with these people rather than at them. That's not something I want. You know, I don't want him to be ashamed of possibly being gay. But I just think that thread needed to have been picked at earlier in order, because he seems to make such a... He doesn't so much question whether he might be gay. He's just go, oh, well, I'm gay then. And he does for about 10 minutes where he's just like, oh, I'm gay then. You know, and I just feel like it needed picking a little bit earlier. And actually, if they didn't do it anywhere else, it was very easy to do once the ghosts really show up, you know?
Yeah.
I just needed a bit more about him. As I say, it didn't, by no means does it not work. Just for me watching, it's just one of those things where it's good, but I think it could be better. Do you know what I mean? Constantly, because I've thought about this a lot since I finished watching. It was only a couple of hours ago, but I've just constantly been thinking, again, just coming back to our process, because it does feel so similar to us stylistically. And I think it's just missed that really fucking horrible falling out pass of reading a script where we just tell each other everything that we don't want to hear. And you go away thinking, oh, well, fuck you then. And it takes you.
Yeah.
And it
takes Nobody speaks to each other for like a day or so. And there's a bit of an awkward tension. And then we just all get over it.
Yeah, you all get over it. You go, no, actually, you were totally right.
Yeah. But you do have that like day where you're sat there stewing.
You just go, oh, fuck you. Yeah, fuck you. You just don't understand it. Like, that's what this missed. Because I think it missed that, and I think there is actually reparation be made for that, which is what's been taken back out. That is what it feels like to me. But we'll never know. But as I say, never mind. What we're left with is still good. I still really enjoyed it, and I would recommend it to people. So I just feel like it could genuinely be fucking brilliant. It really could. They just missed that mark slightly.
It could be up there
as
a Beetlejuice.
Yeah, definitely. Like, type thing. Yeah, definitely. You just missed that mark slightly because of things like that. So all right then. So Emma then flies off to work. And I think this is the first point where I really like understand what we're going to get and the level of the humor is when she uncovers the mural, and it's and I mean it's two guys fucking each other, but they don't just let you see it. You know, there's three ways you could approach this, right? They could just leave it there and then it wouldn't be funny at all. Or they could go the homophobia route and have the guy looking over her shoulder be like quite horrified for, and try and reach for comedy that way, which they don't.
Nope.
They just matter-of-factly go for the gag of, oh, wow, they're butt-fucking, and just leave it there and cut. And it's actually like that's enough. That's enough.
Yeah.
Just it's enough of a... It's enough of a reaction, but it's not over the top. So that made me laugh. And then you cut straight to the fireman calendar in the house. So you've got the 1-2 punch and you're like, this is going to be pretty sophisticated, which I wasn't expecting. in terms of its humor, I mean, you know, it's not just taking pot shots. Don't get me wrong. It's not witty and sophisticated, but it's not taking pot shots. This isn't Benny Hill. Benny Hill gets name dropped later on, in fact. But this isn't Benny Hill. So, and then once I understood that, one thing I really like, right? You know, I'm really enjoying a film, or at least I know I'm really enjoying a film. And I think I've said this on the podcast before. When I'm always just about 10 to 15 seconds in front of the filmmakers, I love that, because for me, that tells me that we're on the same level to start with. Like, they're tuned into my wavelength, so I'm going to find it entertaining. But there's no way to say this without sounding arrogant, but, you know, I am who I am, right? I make films, and I will judge others based on the way that I make films. So if I'm able to run 10 to 15 seconds in front of you and you do exactly what I expect you to, then that shows to me that you know what you're doing. If I'm running 10 to 15 seconds in front of you and you manage to pull a rug out from under me entirely, then you are a fucking genius, right?
Yeah.
So that's how I always know I'm into a film, is when I'm just getting in front of it and I'm not interested. I'm actually so into it that I'm constantly reading about 10 to 15 seconds in front. And so when he's had the fireman calendar, and he's had the first kind of tip off that there's these ghosts in his house, and he walks in and he just walks past the pool table and takes a quick look over to it. And in my head, I've gone, oh, please let there be a cock and balls on the pool table. Because that was the point where I was like, if there's a cock and balls on this pool table, I am 100% into this film because they are working on my level. And sure enough, on the pool table, great big cock and balls. And I'm just like, right, I'm in, you've got me. Like, this is going to be fucking brilliant. And again, it's just left there. They don't make a big deal out of it. He just looks at it and he's like, what the fuck? And then you get the shot and away it goes. Like, they don't make any more of it. So that was very, very funny. Because I've actually written, please let there be a cock and balls on the pool table. And then my very next note is just, yes, with an exclamation point. I've then got, and again, you know, when you can get in front of me and you go somewhere I don't expect, I like it. What's with the bored wife? I feel like she exists solely as a red herring for the gays. Now, immediately they call me on that because he does turn her down straight away. And then assume that she's the one taking photographs of him. So I'm like, right, okay. So I think I'm right at this point because that's what they've done. They've put her there as a red herring. Don't really like it. It feels a bit cheap. But I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Of course, we do then later find that she's a beard. And this becomes a running joke. Like, oh, she's gone off on a private holiday with her gym instructor for 15 days, but she's left her kit here and things like that. So it becomes a running gag. So then Emma returns home. They start to get it on, and they are rudely interrupted by the strains of rah-rah Rasputin coming from the basement. And I lost my shit. I've just written, it's rah-rah Rasputin. Could have been any song in the world, couldn't it? Could have been anything.
Yeah.
But they decided to go with rah-rah Rasputin.
It's also in that scene, it's the fact that he's like, why are they playing rah-rah Rasputin? And she's like, why are you talking about Rashomon? He's like, no, the song by Boney M, you know. And it's the case of, there's that moment where he's like genuinely connecting with the song and you get the sense that she just doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Mm. And I was like,
oh, no, that's the second time, actually, isn't it? Yeah, it is a good song choice. And that gag is brilliant. Second time in it. Sorry, the first time we've written Rara Rasputin, she's on the other end of the phone, isn't she? Because she phones him and she's trying to get through, but he's had to put headphones on to go to sleep because they're playing Rara Rasputin. So loud. Yeah. And then her colleague is trying to bone her and he's just like, oh, well, if he's not answering, well, the cat's away and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't like, actually, the sowing the seeds with her. I was a bit like, is there a point to any of this? Because she was talking about a baby 10 minutes ago and now she's being hit on by a coach. So I didn't like that. However, again, bearing in mind where I thought the film was going at this point,
yeah,
I didn't think it was going to end up being what it was going to be. With it ending up being a rom-com, in retrospect, I like that they did that with her because it just doesn't make her this kind of perfect, unobtainable male fantasy figure. It makes her a person where she's actually starting to question this and go, well, actually, I can fuck off with this guy. I'm not just here solely for you. So in retrospect, I like it. But at the time, as I was watching through and making these notes, I was just like, oh, this feels a bit wrong. But it's not. And then, again, every time I've found this film really funny, they've just got in front of, because the ghosts start pulling the sheets to have a look at his butt.
Yes.
And I've just gone, oh, because please.
He's got a very good butt.
Yeah. Please let them do a sheet ghost. Please, please. And they do. This film just got me on every level, honestly. It's just like, I would have done that. Well done. So again, very, very funny. I wish Mark was here for this bit, because probably the biggest point in this whole film where I was just sucked out of the entire thing. He goes to work. He gets lambasted for being late for work because he hasn't slept all night, and we start to realize he's got some problems at work. So he has a bad day. And then he goes home in a huff. Now, he works on a construction site, and he walks through the door, takes off his hard hat and ear defenders, and hangs them on a coat hook. Who the fuck does that? They live in the car. You don't take
them. Yeah, they live in your boot, don't they?
Yeah, you don't fucking take them home and hang them up. I've never seen that in my life. What the fuck was that about? Totally unnecessary.
Because they were seeding it for the village people gag later on.
I mean, that is the only explanation I could come up with, because as he did it, I was just like, one of the gays is putting those on. Like, that's the only reason.
The same way as when he's like looking through the house and it's panning along and you get the Indian headdress just like laid over with all the boxes and stuff are in one of the rooms. And it's like, hang on, we've got the hard hat. We've got the Indian headdress. I know where this is going.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was obvious. There was obviously going to be a village people gag. So while he's at work, he gets a phone call from Emma and she's chewing his ear off about not answering the phone the night before. He can't really speak to her because he's worried about his boss. And she nags him about the wardrobe. Have you put the wardrobe up yet? And he's like, yeah, of course I have. And then he goes home to find that mysteriously, not only has the wardrobe been constructed, but all of his clothes have been perfectly ironed, folded, and hung. And even his jeans have a crease. They've ironed his jeans with a crease. Hilarious. Again, just because when I was a kid, going back to the whole disco thing, when I was a kid and my mum ironed my clothes, I always had a crease in my jeans because that was the style at the time in the 70s when she was going to clubs. So that one really hit with me, the crease in the jeans. I was just like, yeah, I know where that's coming from. They do the ironing for him. That's really, really good. And then she comes home and then she starts to suspect something because she comes in, she sees the wardrobe. She says, oh, you did put the wardrobe up. And then she's opened it and she's like, all the clothes are ironed. Does your mistress do your ironing for you? And it, again, quite a funny line. Like, it gives her a lot of authority in that scene. Like, she's not accusing him of having an affair, but she is just like, hold on a minute. This is a bit off.
There's red flag number one, you don't answer late at night when you're supposed to be at home. Red flag number two, your clothes are ironed. You don't know what an iron is.
Yeah, you've no idea. Yeah. Your mistress has done your ironing for you. But then they get to fucking and they're disturbed by Rara Rasputin. She rolls over and he almost saves it. He almost manages to bring it back around until they have the conversation in which she's like, why are you going on about Rasputin? He goes, no, it's not Rasputin. It's Boney M. They sing it. Bunch of black guys. And she just loses it. And the delivery is so pitch perfect. I'm just like, no, you misunderstood me. Like,
yeah.
It's exactly the kind of argument you can only have with someone you live with at like 2 a.m. where you're just like, no, shut up. Stop being stupid. I'm not talking about Rasputin. I'm talking about Boney M.
Why are you not following my incoherent train of thought that is happening at 2 a.m. that is completely non-secular to what we've talked about before?
Why do you not understand me? Brilliant. Such a funny exchange. Played really well. Okay. So I kind of lose it on my notes a bit here then, because it is from here on out that I'm just like, this is brilliant. This is just absolutely brilliant. And as ghosts go, is my next note here. As ghosts go, these guys are fucking awesome. You know, some people get bleeding walls. Some people get like demonic possession. You know, this guy gets basement discos and his clothes ironed for him. Like what?
Yeah.
Like if you're going to have ghosts, I want these ghosts. Like,
I mean, I was a little bit like, I am 100% here for having an army of 5 gay ghosts in my flat
totally.
At all times.
Just, what a scream.
Do you know
right?
what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, make yourselves at home, dudes.
Yeah. And I also like, you know, this is where things start to get a little bit unhinged for him anyway. Like, he's had two sleepless nights. His long-term girlfriend's come back and she's a bit like, she suspects him of having an affair. He's starting to unravel and he's starting to see some things as well. You know, he's seen the cock on the pool table. He's seen the cock painted on the wall. So he's starting to get a little bit kind of tetchy and paranoid. And I really like the reversal of trope here, because in a standard horror film, this would be the wife every time.
Yeah.
10 times out of 10. She's the one that starts climbing the walls first. Yeah, and the husband doesn't believe her because he's too busy out of work all day and he doesn't see all the shit that's going on in the house. So I really like the subversion of the trope of like the alpha male actually being the one that's going like... And of course it makes sense then when it starts to get explained later on as well that they have actually deliberately subverted this trope, and that's the reason why he can see the gay ghosts and some of the other people can't, and the women certainly can't, is because the ghosts are projecting themselves onto the objects of their desire. And so it's just a really nice, again, not done in any offensive way whatsoever, not done to try and be outwardly nor inwardly homophobic, just a matter of fact thing of like, actually, guys can kind of be pussies too, even if they're big, strong builders who are built like a brick shit house. Like, this can happen to them too, you know? So yeah, I really like that subversion of tropes. I thought it was really clever. And then we get the revelation that she can't see the ghosts. This is the point where, like, because he's talking to them in the basement and she comes down.
He's gone down. He's lost his shit. He's got a shovel in his hand.
Yeah.
They've been offering him wine and everything and he is beyond pissed. And she comes in, she can't see them. And Dave comes in and can't see them either. The only one that can see them is Mark.
Yeah, that's right. And this, again, is a point where I've written, for that scene to have really worked, I think we needed to spend more time with Mark to see, like, he broke very quickly is the thing.
Yeah.
And again, the information was there. Like I said, he's had two sleepless nights. He's just out of Barney with her as well. But I feel like, but again, at this point, I thought we were having a horror film. So I was like, hang on, that wasn't a very slow build. It's just like, here's the ghosts, ta-da, and he's gone crazy. I think if this has a problem with pacing at all, it's from here to the ghosts going, okay, we're going to help him win her back. Because this is the point where the wheels come off a little bit and he doesn't quite know what it is. It kind of, from this point on, it needed to flick the switch immediately. Like, they needed to fall out very quickly after this, and the ghosts needed to feel very guilty very quickly after this. But there is still a good 10 to 15 minutes of the ghosts being just a little bit antagonistic. And at this point as well, when they're saying to him, like, this is our house and you need to leave, like, I get it, that's standard horror movie stuff, but I don't feel like we've got enough backstory on them to be having that conversation yet either. It comes later, you know, we get what's gone on, and we kind of saw it at the start, but just feel like, you know, this is the first time we've really seen them, and they're just matter-of-factly going, no, we live here, you can go. Something about it just didn't sit with me.
The reason why it doesn't work is because it doesn't fit with the characters and it doesn't fit with the film. And it's there purely because that's the trope of the haunted house thing, is the ghosts want the owners out and then they have to come to an understanding. And it's like, but the thing about this film is that although that's how it pitches itself, that's not what the film is. And so they didn't need the ghosts to be like, you need to get out. If anything, it would have been better if they'd done the flip of that and it was a case of the ghosts were like, you need to accept the fact that we're
that's
also
exactly
here and we're
what
all
it
roommates.
It, what and, it sh- yeah, what it should have been was the ghost going, come on in, join the conga.
Yeah.
And him being like, no,
somebody
get
knew.
The fuck out of my house.
Yeah, and it should have been the ghost being like, somebody new. Why are you being so antagonistic to us? Look, we've helped you. We've put up your wardrobe for you. We've done this for you. We've done this for you. Like, we're being so hospitable, like making you feel at home in our home. Mm. Why can't you show us the same courtesy? It, that needed to have been
that. It definitely did. And I still think you could have done that without leaning into homophobia. You could have done that just from the point of view of like, this is this guy's basement. And these people, we don't even know, he doesn't know they're ghosts at this point. He just thinks there are some people there having a party in his basement.
Yeah.
You definitely could have gone down that route. And I think actually that works better narratively then as well, because then his behavior solely drives her away. Whereas the route they take, the ghosts push that behavior on him. Like they are quite antagonistic when he's trying to prove they're there and they're just like, I'm not going to catch the glass. Fuck you. I'm gonna let the glass smash and make you look like a crazy person. And I'm going to drive you to the point where you beat up your father-in-law. Like, if that was just him, like, if he'd have gone, like, full-on crazy just try and get them out of the house, then that's his behaviour that's driven her away. And then he's got to confront that himself. This makes much more sense, Helen. This may be the missing information we're looking for, actually. It's the first time, I think, I've properly put a finger on what I wanted, and I think you're right, that's it. I think they needed to subvert this trope. And then we understand what he needs to do to win her back, because it was his behavior in the first place. So then showing that he's moved on and grown and accepted these house guests.
Yeah.
You know.
Because that's his character flaw that he's got in the middle, is he's too self-centered, is he can't see outside of himself.
Yes.
And so by literally having like these unwanted people that also live in the house with him, he could think that they're squatters. He could think that this is maybe part of the problem with because the house was willed and it stood there empty for 30 years. You've got squatters' rights. They're a big thing in France. Like, that could have been like the whole shit. We've got this problem. We're not going to deal with this. And so then you have to start thinking outside of yourself to start being open to the other person. And because he's having to do that in order to resolve the conflict, that's what then prompts the 100% character growth and everything else.
100%. Yeah. That is what pushes this film over into being genuinely really fucking good. That's the missing link. That's what the story needed. And that's all it needs for that final act to land as well. Shame. Because what's here actually is fine. Like, this doesn't... It's not that this doesn't work. It just feels at odds with what comes after, but it does give us the information that we need. He can see them, no one else can. They're ghosts. They think it's their house. They're trapped out of time. And then for the next 5 to 10 minutes or so is probably the weakest part of the film, where they're just antagonizing him, and like, he's showering in his pajamas and stuff like that because he doesn't want him taking photos of his bum and all that kind of stuff. And it's funny, don't get me wrong, but it's just not really doing anything.
Because the problem is with them being sort of, with them having chosen to take that antagonistic route and him responding, feeling sort of like quite victimized for legitimate reasons. I mean, people, personal space and body autonomy is very important.
Totally.
Is it does then kind of start to sort of suggest that these ghosts are going to be sort of like the threat or the antagonist. And that's not what you want in this film. And that's not the route that they go down. Because the reason why I think the next bit doesn't work is because when they made that decision, they very quickly realized that's pushing them down an angle which is going to go somewhere that they absolutely don't want to go, and that's going to feel very icky.
Yep.
And so they very abruptly reverse course, and they just about pull it off. But the whole point is, the reason why that section doesn't work is because they're literally digging themselves out of the hole that they've just created. And then once they've got themselves out of the hole, the film then flies.
Yeah, totally agree. I've actually made a note of it here. I said back at the start, there are some points where the representation gets a bit close to the bone, and this was it for me. This is the only point where the ghosts feel vaguely predatory to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they are being quite pervy in places.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm not here for the trope of predatory gaze.
Yeah, not at all.
Taking advantage of the poor straight men.
And that trope is particularly leveled at camper gaze as well.
Massively.
That is a trope that it's got, and that's just simply just a distasteful characterization that doesn't need to be there. And you're right, they realize and they pull back from it. But yeah, I commented on that as well. I didn't like it. This 10 minutes is the weakest of the film, but it gets us where we need to go. They drive him to the brink of absolute insanity, to the point where he's chasing them around the house with a shovel. And he ends up basically beating the shit out of his future father-in-law with a shovel and getting him taken off in an ambulance. The one part of this 10-minute segment that I did really like was the dad going into the kitchen to borrow the drill or whatever it is, and seeing like all the photos on the fridge and the shopping list that just had like KY jelly, poppers,
handcuffs,
LSD, and then seeing the naked photos on the fridge. I was just, that's funny. That's really fucking funny. And again, not offensive. Those are just observations. No. Like that's fine. It's when it's leveled at someone.
Yeah, and it fuels the fact that the father's just like, who is this man? What are you doing to my poor, pure, innocent daughter?
Totally.
Like, yeah, that works.
Very well. So, and even like the ultimate act of like, you know, that the final straw is him kicking the shit out of her dad. Like that works as well, you know, because she doesn't feel like she's suspicious of him, but she never really feels like she's ready to just chuck it all in. Like we said at the start, she's talking about the next step, but this is something that's so egregious. It's like, enough's enough. You just beat my dad up. Go and get help, you fucking lunatic. And that's what forces him then into going to get his head shrunk. So my notes, I've only got, like, from here on out, I've got like 2/3 of a page of notes, and that's it, because this is the point where the film flips the switch, and I'm 100% in. And it's very specifically, so we're about 40 odd minutes in the film, half hour to 40 minutes in the film here. So it's a very long first act, but this is the end of the first act. She leaves him, and then all the gays are looking through the window, and they feel guilty, and they're like, we need to help him get her back. And that's the point
this poor broken man. And also we also quite like Emma. We approve of Emma. And that was the other thing as well that made it. Wasn't just, we're taking pity on him because he's got very pretty pecs, and no man with pecs that good deserves to cry. It was also the fact that we like Emma and we approve of this relationship and we want to help them with the relationship. So again, it was having had that moment where it got a little bit predatory, the fact that they were actively like embracing and supporting just this relationship because they liked her. It wasn't a case of, well, yeah, but she's a girl, so we'll just get rid of her. Like, that was the moment where I was just like, the ghost characters, I feel, all of a sudden come into their own at that point.
Totally. And this was the point where they completely flipped the narrative.
Yeah.
It became something entirely different. And it's the mission statement. It's right there. There's your end of Act One mission statement. This is the plot of the film. Now, you called it right. Now we've basically got Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, but they're ghosts. And it's at that point the film just goes, this is what you're going to watch now for the next hour. And I'm like, right, I'm fine. Yeah. I'm 100% fine with that. I am up for this. This is far better than you trying to just fuck around with him in-house on his own. and haunt the house. Yeah. That was, it was already getting old. So, and I was fully in, like I said, 2/3 of a page of notes, and most of it is just me calling out everything that I thought was really well done or that was really funny. So he goes to see his shrink. His shrink very predictably says that he's a closeted homosexual and he just needs to pay him for the privilege of telling him that. He goes outside and has a bit of a cry. In actually a really good fucking scene. Like, his performance is solid. There, no words spoken whatsoever. He just goes outside, collapses on the steps, and breaks down. And it's not that he's broken down because he might be gay. It's he's broken down because his whole fucking world is falling apart. And he plays that perfectly. And again, that could have been very dangerous. Going into that territory, that could have been quite a negative portrayal. But it's not, because I think he plays it right anyway. But then the very next scene is him going to see Dave. And they break the tension with a bit of comic relief with the fact that his missus is off on her gym trip. And she's left all her gym clothes here. And then he just tells Dave what's going on. Like, he's gay. And Dave's like, yeah, whatever. It doesn't even bat an eyelid. He's like, yeah, fine.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Do what you want,
mate. What's your boyfriend called? And he's like, I haven't got one. He goes, what do you mean you've not got boyfriends? How do you know you're gay if you've not got boyfriends?
Yeah, and I think there's just something about that scene that's, like I said, having personally been in that situation, and I can speak from experience with it to a certain extent, there's something about that scene that's just really nicely observed, because that is not how that scene is normally played in cinema at all. They normally make a huge thing out of it. And it doesn't have to be a huge thing. It's, you know, it's just, especially in this situation, this isn't somebody that's been closeted for years and it needs to be a big celebratory thing. This is somebody that actually might be struggling with this a little bit. So you just go, all right, it's fine. You know, we'll deal with it. We'll move on. I thought it was really nice. There was a really nice scene between the two of them, and there was potential for it to have gone very wrong.
That was when all of a sudden I was like, oh, I don't need to actually worry about this film.
Me too. That was the point where I was like, no, they get it. They're actually going to be really respectful about all of this. Like, it's fine. They're treating all of these people as people, and that's good. And then just to make sure that you fully understand what side of the fence they're on, we get the grandma, which...
Oh, best scene in the film. Amazing. Best scene in the film.
Amazing.
Oh my God, I love her.
Amazing, because the whole setup of it with, like, you first of all, you get like the mum and the dad looking at him like, you're what, and you feel like it's going to go very, very wrong, because they're a very traditional kind of Italian family, and you can see the old nonna at the top of the table with the tiramisu and everything, and you're expecting it to go very, very wrong, and like the way it's handled initially is just like, yeah, that's cool. Don't worry about anything. Oh, well, that's lovely, right? Because that's a granny for you, right? At the end, there's a proper granny. Like, even if
I was worried you didn't like my tiramisu.
Yeah.
He's like, no, the tiramisu is great. She's like, oh, then we're fine.
But it's the slow build from that, isn't it? It's the slow build of, like, that's fine. I was just worried you didn't like the tiramisu. To, you know, when I was younger, there was this girl. And then to go into explicit detail, and then to end on, yeah, well, the thing is, your granddad was shit in bed.
And the fact that they're having this conversation in Italian, so the smaller children around the table don't understand what's being said, and the adults are like practically pissing themselves with laughter because the granddad's just sat there looking really upset, and the grandmother's just having this wonderful time reminiscing about this beautiful apricot of a woman that she used to have every Tuesday and wash days.
What an amazing scene. Like, you know, if you want to look at the anatomy of a scene, just from everything, from a screenwriting point of view, from a blocking point of view as well, the way they're in really tight all the time as well, and they just push around the table. Like, the slow build of the performance is perfect. What a perfect little scene. It's its own little comedy sketch in a lot of respects. Like, you could slice that out of the film entirely, and it would still work. It's that good of a scene. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And then, like, the laughs just keep on coming from this point out, and literally all of it, probably my favorite line in the entire film, and it's a really fucking stupid one. I forget that I'm crap with character names unless I've seen something loads of times, right? But there's the two guys that are in the relationship, and one of them is into women.
He's the bi one.
He's the bi one. And there's a there's a point where he's looking at the paper or something. And the other guy goes, "What are you looking at?" And he just goes, "Just some sharks." And then he comes over and picks up and it's page three, and he goes, "What are they? Hammer tit sharks?"
Yeah, it
killed me. Hammer tit sharks absolutely floored me. It's A, such a fucking stupid, ridiculous line, but it's B, again, you know, knowing some of these people in real life and seeing them represented is absolutely words I can hear coming out of some of my friends' mouths. Like, what is it? A hammer tit shark. Like, so fucking funny. And it's one that's filed away in my mental box. Like, hammer tit shark is going to become a thing for me. I can see it happening. Such a stupid joke. But he's played so fucking well. Because he's just in the middle of doing the ironing as well. He just comes out of nowhere. What is it? A fucking hammer tit shark. Great. Absolutely great. And then, yeah, I'm just going to talk to him. Oh, whilst all this is going on, he's gone to a gay bar. He's nervously had a chat with the barman and ordered himself a whiskey. And he's in a crumpled suit. Couldn't be a straight man in a gay bar anymore if he tried. And then,
which is kind of the point at this stage. Because
totally. Yeah.
Mark is not gay.
No,
he's
absolutely
trying, bless
not.
Him,
he's trying.
But he's not gay.
No, he's trying to fit into the box that society has now told him he belongs in. Even though he doesn't really believe that's where he belongs, that's the box he's going to try and fit in. And again, such a lovely reversal of trope. And one that's done without hammering it home, without being really on the nose about it. You know, and I think a lot of credit comes down to the actor for that as well.
Yes.
He's very, very good. He's clearly very uncomfortable, but he's giving it a go. And then, of course,
He's nervous, but it's not because he's scared about what happened. He's like, well, I'm gay, but I don't know how to pick up men and I don't know how to do this. And that's where it's coming from. It's coming from just he's not been in the position where he's had to sort of go out on the pool and enter a dating scene that functions very differently, which is where the humour's coming from. Is the humour's coming from the fact that that dating scene functions very differently than the dating scene that he is used to.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, you've got the stereotypical gay bar scene then as well. But again, stereotypical because in fairness, in my experience at least, it's true. You know, you've got the two guys there then, and the one's like, he's a straight man, I'm going to turn him. Like, definitely, I'm all about this. They know he's straight, they know he isn't gay, but he's going to have a go anyway. But again, like, there's a way to play that. If you wanted to now, with where we are narratively, there's a way to play that where he's a threat and he's quite predatory and he's not really. He just kind of goes over to him and he has a chat. And he's forward. He's very forward. Yeah. But he never really pushes it, you know? I think the closest he comes to pushing it is putting his hand on his thigh, which, you know, they're in a club. They're having a few drinks.
Yeah.
Like, it's
a signal of interest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think actually even here that character could have been a lot worse, and he's not. You know, and then they leave. You know, Mark is then like nervous. He doesn't know what to do. So he's like, oh, well, you know, talk to me first. Basically, buy me a drink first. Talk to me. You know, I'm not that kind of guy. Not on the first date. And then they decide like they're going to go for dinner, and then they're in his car and they're going back to the house. But then he's like, oh, no, actually not to my house, because my house is full of raging fairies and they're going to think this is hilarious, so we'll stop in the park. And then again, very, very funny scene where he's just like, oh, you work, because he mentions he works on a building site. He's like, oh, my first time was with a Turkish builder and it was amazing. And then he says, put your helmet on and talk Turkish to me. And all Mark can come out with is kebab. Which again, just killed me. Like, talk Turkish to me, kebab.
I mean, if you as a viewer were in any doubt as to whether Mark was gay or straight, his lack of game, firmly establishes
completely
that this is not his scene.
Completely. So then the guy gets really turned on. Whops his old boy out. Mark's just about, he's thinking about going down on him. He doesn't want to. Again, he's played very well, but he's like, I need to do this because
I need to see
find
this
out. Yeah, yeah, I need to find out. And then the cops show up. Cops who had incidentally already been round his house, found his blunt, because he phoned them when the wardrobe was put together and reported it as a crime.
Yeah. And the painting of the cock and balls was on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. And they obviously didn't take him seriously, found his blunt and were just like, oh, he's a waste of space, he's a stoner, what have you, this is a warning kind of thing. So then they catch him again, and they bust him for indecent exposure. So he spends the night in the cells, which means he's missed numerous phone calls from Emma. He's late for work, so he gets the sack, and his life really is falling apart. Also, he now knows he is not gay. He knows in his head that he's not gay anyway, but society is still telling him that he is. So he trudges home, back to see our gays. And this is where he starts to get a bit proactive about it. He's just like, right, let's find out what's happened. So, he, you know, it's the early 2000s. So what does he do? He goes on Google. He finds out what happens with the nightclub. And then he takes the news article down to the gays. And then they have just like a little bit of a bro moment, really. All of them just sit together on the couch, have a bit of a chat. We find out about what's his name? Huggy. We find out about Huggy.
Yeah.
And this is all a collection of scenes now in the house where he's just growing closer to the gays. There's that brilliant skit as well where the main gay, the lead gay, I don't know his name either, just walks through the wall and he goes, look, please, in the house, can we use doors? So he walks back through the wall and walks straight through the door. Like stupid slapstick shit, but it's very, very funny. And we find out that he had a partner called Huggy, who was supposed to go to the club for his 30th birthday party that night. He never saw him. He doesn't know if he's dead. He's never seen him since, and he's very, very worried.
It's the love of his life.
It's the love of his life. Yeah,
that's gone. The one thing that this he's like, it's the one thing that I need in order to be able to feel at peace.
Yeah,
is I need to know what happened.
Yeah,
and I also think that having that story there also helps with the ghost's investment in Mark, because as Mark is like, I'll help you find Huggy and what is with Huggy, it then means that they've got the reciprocality.
Yes.
Which then we'll get you back, Emma. Like, we'll both help each other out.
Yeah, totally.
Which I thought was a nice touch.
And the film gets so good from here on out that my next note is actually at the very end. I've got nothing.
Oh, really?
I can remember pretty much everything that happened because it's so fucking good. But my next notes are at the end, and it's about how good all of this is. So yeah, we find out about Huggy. He shows them what happened with the nightclub. He calls an exorcist of sorts who comes in. Again, perfectly played. Like the way he comes in, and he just hates them because they're ghosts. He doesn't hate them because they're gay or anything like that, or they're flamboyant. Yeah. He just hates ghosts because it's his job to get rid of ghosts. And actually, as he gets to know them, he becomes completely ambivalent towards them anyway, because he's one of the people that can see them. And then he builds a relationship with them to the point where he's actually in the bar at the end. So, you know, there's that as well. So they start off not liking each other. The reveal of him being able to see them works very well as well before he actually dumps the lore on us of who can see them and who can't. Actually, before he comes round, the dad comes around to pick his car keys up.
Yeah.
Again, perfectly delivered scene where they're having their village people party behind Mark. They're all congering through, all dressed up in various outfits. And the dad's like, no, I'm not coming in. Doesn't reference the fact that all the ghosts are behind him at all. Even though they've stopped because they see the dad and they kind of freeze in their tracks, the party stops and they're just looking at him. And he has a conversation with Mark, and as he's leaving, he just goes, gentlemen. And they just let it drop for a minute. And you're like, that's brilliant.
All of a sudden, it clicks with Mark, because that's what prompts him to get the exorcist. Because all of a sudden, he realizes it's not in his
head.
It's
not in his
head.
They are ghosts. They are ghosts.
And someone else can see them.
Yeah, he knows what's going on. That's what kicks him off into the whole like researching it stuff as well. All of this stems from that moment. So he goes, he immediately makes it worse again by running out and jumping on the car and screaming at him like a madman. But he's made a bit of a breakthrough. So then the exorcist comes in. He sort of drops the science. And again, initially playing off like he can't see the ghosts, just they're there listening to him, but he's not reacting to them at all. Until I guess the very end of the scene, and then he turns and addresses them directly, and it's like, well, of course he can see them. He's a fucking exorcist. Of course he could, like, it's his fucking job, right? And then he drops all the science about how, like, the reason some people can see them and some people can't is because ghosts are seen by the object of their desires, because they want to be seen. They desire to be seen because they've ceased to exist. So, so that's why, basically, only straight people can see them. Like, if you've had any
people that have never had impure touch
any interaction any interaction,
because that's why Dave can't see them, because Dave is a medical profession that has to cup the balls while the firemen cough.
Well,
I mean, Dave's just a little bit of just, he's in his own Dave land, like, I think Dave is Dave sexual.
Quite possibly But yeah, there's that whole, that's the whole explanation for it, basically. And it, again, that makes perfect sense. Like, they drop that science. I don't need to question it. I'm just like, yeah, fine. I'll run with that. That's absolutely fine. It pays off very nicely with the cops. The third time we run into the cops then as well, where all the gays are in the back of the car and he's almost done for speeding. So there's this thing that the exorcist says there's these keystones, because apparently the house is built on a Templar church. Again, fine, whatever. It's very late in the day to be dropping this science, but whatever, it works. It's just some fucking rubbish MacGuffin shit that we need in here.
It explains why they can't leave the house.
Yeah, it's fine. So they work out that if they put the stones in the car and then in a wheelbarrow and they move the stones about, the ghosts can go outside. And they can kind of move around. So they all go out for a night out against the exorcist's advice, because initially Mark does say, if I put one stone in every corner of the country, they could be free. Which is the first real point where you start to see his feelings towards them have properly changed. It's not just that he wants them out of the house now. It's like, you know, well, I want them to have freedom. I want them to be able to go and live their afterlife as such. You know, they can go and do what they want to do. So he's looking for the best outcome for them. The exorcist is just like, no, what we have to do is open a portal to hell and then they'll all get sucked into it. Or the netherworld.
It's not to hell, it's to reincarnation.
Yeah, that's right, reincarnation.
Yeah.
That's what he says. Which at one point, they wrong-footed me slightly here, and I prefer what they did. But at one point, as soon as he started talking about reincarnation, I was just like, I bet Mark is huggy. But they didn't go down that route, and I'm glad they didn't, because again, that would have been cheap. But I was starting to think that would have been very cheap. So he takes them out against the exorcist advice, and then they basically start to have a whitey. He doesn't really see it because he's at the bar talking to the barman, and he recognizes the photograph behind the bar. He sees our lead ghost, our lead gay, and he realizes that the barman is Huggy, which was so beautifully done, because we've already met this character and he was just a throwaway character, and he speaks to him again. It's like, oh shit, you're the guy I've been looking for. And so he goes to tell the ghost, but then realizes they're all having a complete whitey, like their eyes are all rolled back in their head, they're fucking collapsed in a puddle on the dance floor. Basically, they've been away from the house for too long.
They've got to be back in the house by the time of their death, which is 1:55. Otherwise, they will cease to exist.
Otherwise, yeah, they're like Cinderella, basically.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how the film explains it.
Yes. Cinderella with balls.
Cinderella with balls. That's exactly how they explain it. As
in the McDonald's drive-thru.
Because the exorcist is obsessed with McDonald's and gets paid in McDonald's. Because why not? I guess very particular about people stealing his fries. Just great little character touches. He's just such a crotchety old man, you know. So then Mark's just like hauling some serious ass to get him home, gets stopped by the cops because he runs a red light. And this is like, this is it. Third strike and he's out. The cops are about to chuck him in the cell, which is surely going to mean the end of our ghosts because they're not going to be back by 1:55. Until one of the cops then comments on the state of the five guys in the back. They look like they're on something. And of course, the other two cops can't see them. So they then think he's crazy. Of course, he's now outed himself as having had some sort of interaction with male genitalia.
He hasn't. His mate has, who can't see him, because you've got the female cop and you've got the two men. So you've got the one that can see the ghost that's never had the interaction with the male genitalia, but his buddy has, because that's why his buddy can't see him.
Can't see him, but he can. Yeah. So we've got the whole gag there then. So he gets away with it. That works. They get home, they rejuvenate and stuff, and then he gets the phone call. Then he writes a letter, doesn't he? He's accepted that he's got to move on with his life. You know, everything's gone wrong. So he writes the letter, and he says like, "Look, come and pick up your stuff." Yeah, writes the letter to Emma. Come and pick up your stuff. I'm better now. If you want to talk to me, please do. But I understand if you don't. That sort of thing. And then the ghosts pick it up and rewrite it entirely.
They make it much better.
They make it much better. And so then she phones him and she's like, this letter is beautiful, like especially the last passage. And it turns out that he's written poetry and all sorts of shit in there. And so this then is where we get our kind of the start of our third act, where essentially he has to set up the big date. And all of the gay ghosts basically have to essentially ghostwrite, no pun intended, the whole date for him. They're like whispering in his ear, telling him what to say. They're cooking the food. They dress him. They tidy the house. They decorate. They do everything to help him woo her back. Again, it's all played really, really sweetly. Like, at no point does it tip over into being a little bit like, well, hang on, that's not really him, though, is it? Because she calls him on it, and then he dials back on it straight away, and he's like, look, guys, I've still got to be me. We've got to, you know, and he goes in and he smashes the cake up because the cake is too nicely decorated, so they all start crying because he's broken their beautiful cake. And it's just a lovely, lovely scene. Of course, it all works out for the better. They go upstairs to fuck. And as they're doing so, one of the ghosts she has her video camera with her that she uses for work and stuff. And one of the ghosts picks it up. And it turns out the camera can see the ghosts.
Because the camera's never touched
male genitalia. So it makes perfect sense. It does track. I thought that at the time as well. It's like, this tracks because it's a camera.
Really clever.
It's a camera. Yeah. It can't have ever, it's clever. It makes perfect sense.
And it's nice because it is a subversion of the trope that you normally get, which is you can see them in real life and you can't see them on the camera. I just thought that was a really nice...
Yeah, it was. It was. So then she goes downstairs to get a drink. She looks through the camera because he's been busted. So he just drops the camera on the counter quickly and thinks, oh, that's fine. She won't see me. She looks through the camera and she sees him. And so then they're outed, no pun intended again, they're outed. She realizes that there have been ghosts there all along. Everything works itself out. They're absolutely fine. And then the exorcist shows back up and he's like, right, well, I'm glad you've sorted all of this out because I've actually tracked the next date of the next portal to reincarnation. And, of course, this is where you're expecting the gut punch because everything's worked itself out. So you're expecting, like, oh, it's in an hour or it's in 10, you know, and all of a sudden they've got to go. Just as everything's sorted and everyone's friends and they're all besties, like, they've got to go because they've accomplished their mission. It was like, no, it's not for another, 100 years or something. It's like 700 years,
yeah.
So they're stuck there, basically. And so then we cut to what is our epilogue. And it works really, really well. It's a lovely little end to the film. I just think, again, it's lacking some of the satisfaction I wanted from it just because we didn't have the character work earlier. So I feel the ultimate journey for our lead works, but isn't quite there. All of the ghosts, though, get their stories paid off In fact, all of the other characters get their stories paid off beautifully. So they reopen the nightclub in the basement. They put cameras up everywhere so that everyone can see the ghosts on the screens. Huggy comes in and sees the lead ghost, and he can see him on the screen so they can talk to each other. Then all of the ghosts that made the butt fucking mural at her work all come over with her.
Because she transported the lava stones that were keeping them in place.
Yeah, so they all come over. So the club is absolutely bumping. Our medium, our exorcist, is there as well, just having a grand old time because he's just surrounded by ghosts and he's just like, well, whatever. And even before that, some of the stories start to pay off in that we haven't really talked about many of the other ghosts, but they all had a story. Right, there was one that was closeted, even though he's blatantly, flamboyantly gay, but he was, you know, the guy's like, no, I'm not gay. I'm not gay. I'm definitely not gay. So he hooks up with some of these guys at the end. We've got the other one that's actually really aggressively anti-straight people to start with. But then
gay or you're fascist.
Yeah, then learns tolerance and gives a whole speech about acceptance in the kitchen just before they actually start the party. You know, so everybody's story tracks through and it all comes together in just this beautiful disco dancing nightclub finale where everybody's story pays off. And it's
And the dad even shakes Mark's hand because of how successful the nightclub is, and he's doing such a good job, and he's won the father's approval, he's won back the love of his life, he's got his besties with him now.
Yeah, it's just
lovely. Having a great time.
It's just a really lovely ending. Everybody's story pays off. Like I say, the only thing I was left wanting was I didn't feel quite as attached to Mark as I think I could have. I was attached enough to him because I enjoyed the film and he's the lead, but I was far happier for all of the ghosts who I was far more attached to, if I'm honest.
I feel that because it stumbles so much in the first act, I didn't really like Mark as a character. Like, I was accepting him as the main character and I wasn't like upset with him and I wasn't hating him and I wasn't wanting bad things, but I wasn't feeling any sort of connection with him.
Agreed.
As like
a
person or a character. Until the stories, especially the moment for me was when he started questioning if he was gay, and you had that lovely little scene with him and Dave, and then Dave being just like, well, where do I put the painting? And he was just like, oh, I don't fucking know.
Put it in
and
the basement.
Followed
yeah.
by the Italian, yeah, and then followed by the Italian grandmother. And just the way that he embraced that and went on with it, I was just like, actually, I really like you now.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. Once we got into Act Two, I was fine with him. It's just I didn't have enough to understand who he was in Act One other than the everyman.
Why Emma was with him.
Yeah, totally. And I think that does loom large over his ending. But everyone else's story is so concise and works so well. You know, and the payoff with Huggy is just lovely. That's really, really lovely. That was really
and
well
also
executed.
The one that you said as well, the sort of the closeted one that's been constantly saying, I'm not gay, and he has his first kiss.
Yeah.
And just his response to that first kiss is so freaking sweet.
Yeah, it's just lovely. It's a real
it's
nice feel-good ending. And, you know, you end up realizing that you've essentially just watched a 90-minute rom-com when you were expecting a really dodgy horror.
I was expecting a horror comedy, and there's no horror in it. It's not a horror comedy.
Not at all. It's
really
a rom-com.
It's like such a genuine, sweet little story.
It is. It's lovely. He's genuinely lovely.
And I think the bit as well where he's got the ghosts on side and Dave comes round and they're at the pool table and he gets the ghosts are actually on his side now. So they start manipulating the pool balls and things to demonstrate that. That whole scene just plays out beautifully.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is great, but we just needed this a little bit earlier.
We did. Yeah, we did. It's either we needed that earlier, or I think we needed the rest of the information that's missing. And I do genuinely believe there's a good at least 20, because there are a lot of fades to black, a lot of them. I think there's just massive chunks of story that are missing. I think they're skilled enough that they've realized the bare minimum that they have to keep, and that's why it works. And it, you know, when I say it works, I don't mean it's functional. I mean it works well. We're saying we really like it. So, you know, they clearly understand that. And it's rare for me to say that I think it needs more. I would generally be all in favor of like, no, just stick with what you need. Don't have any more on screen than you need. But I don't think they've quite got everything they need is the problem. So I don't know that we needed the stuff earlier. I just think that we needed to see what was before it is the problem.
I think we could have seeded the whole revelation about who can see ghosts and who can't by when she's at Pompeii and they're uncovering the bath thing and you've got the male colleague that's with her and they're in the bar together. If that scene had gone on a little bit longer and so she turned him down and left, if the ghost that had the kiss at the end was just kind of there in the bar and the colleague just saw him and then just sort of like there was just like a little bit of a nod between them, because that would also then set up the ending a little bit, you know. You would have paid that off then, and it also just would have given you something as a bit of a, because it just, the first act just feels lacking, which is again with those fade to blacks and what you're saying with the stuff missing, is it does feel like there's stuff missing in that first
act. But what we're left with all works basically, and it works really well. So yeah, you know, a couple of missteps in the first act, but everything else is so good that they just get away with it. And I have no other notes than that. That is really my only criticism of this film. Everything else I thought was fucking great. I loved it.
Yeah.
I had a really, really good time with this film.
So did I.
Yeah. I'll definitely watch it again. I'll definitely recommend it to people. I'm going to be telling Mark to watch it if he doesn't anyway, because I think Mark will really get a kick out of it as well. Because I know he loves a rom-com, and it genuinely feels like something we would write. I can really see us writing something like this. Yeah, it's great. All right, so I think we know the answer, but we got to ask the question, like, is it better than Mario?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Very much so.
I agree.
Yeah, it's got heart.
It's got a hell of a lot of heart.
It's got so much heart. And like, this is one of these things, and I know we keep coming back to this, is it's sometimes you haven't got a lot of budget, sometimes you haven't got a lot of experience, but if you've got a lot of heart, that always shines through with what you're making. And
totally.
Like this film's got it in spades. And just, I need to stress as well just how refreshing like all of the representation and just the attitude that it took to this. It was, as I said, there was a couple of moments very sort of early on where I was just like, oh please, let's not go down the predatory gay route. Like I don't really want, and just no, just completely dodged.
Yeah, they pulled back from it, and they don't make fun of the fact that they're flamboyant and camp either. No. They don't go down that route and ridicule them. Like I said, they even call attention to that. At one point, one of them turns around and goes, oh, shut up, Benny Hill. You know, like they draw attention to that. And I think that's, even today, that's quite refreshing. Because unfortunately, that is still a trope that we see in popular culture a lot today. I think everything is really well handled. I'll rank it amongst some of the best things we've watched, I'll be honest, for this show anyway. It's up there. I think it's really fucking good. Obviously, tonally very different to the usual stuff we watch, you know. So it's probably the only rom-com that ranks highly on the list. But yeah, this is really fucking good. So over to you, listeners. Let us know what you think. Have you seen this? Will you now go out and watch it? Because we've basically had an hour and a half love-in for it. Let us know what you think. Or have we got the wrong end of the stick completely and you think this is an absolute pile of trash? I don't see how you can come to that conclusion unless you wanted a really schlocky horror film and were disappointed. In which case, go and watch Bunny the Killer Thing instead and fuck you. Yeah, let us know what you think. As always, you know, you can reach out to us on all the usual channels. Mark is not here to do the socials, and I'm not going to pretend like I looked them up. I know we're ddpodcast.net. And I think on everything else, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, it's DD Podcast or DD Flicks. I don't know. You'll find us. Type in Double Down. But we're Double Down Podcast Network. Yeah, just type that in. I don't normally do this bit, listeners. I start the show. Mark ends the show.
I'm just here for the ride.
Yeah. I don't know. You can find us if you want us. You can leave us a message on DD Podcast. And the one thing we do always appreciate, wherever you found this podcast, please rate and leave a review. It does help other people find us. So if you like our bullshit, then please tell other people you like our bullshit. So that's it, I guess. That's Poltergeist in a nutshell. It is better than Mario. So until next time, see you later.
Ta-ra.